This week on Disaffected, a New Hampshire legislator used all the tools of a narcissistic abuser to slander a citizen in an open hearing. We'll go through the video step by step to point out the tactics of the Cluster B abuser and how to respond to them. Grab a pen and paper because you'll want to take notes. Then we'll look at the disturbing trend of trans women trying to rehabilitate the moral character of the most famous serial killer in cinema history, Buffalo Bill from The Silence of the Lambs. And finally, we're going to unmask the flying monkeys. Like the winged primates who carried out the Wicked Witch's dirty work, millions of otherwise normal people have been conscripted into an abusive army. They silence and punish anyone who disagrees with the narcissistic project that we know as trans activism. All that and more this week on Disaffected. Welcome to Disaffected. I'm Joshua Slocum. This is the show that talks about the personal and the political. The point of the show is to show people how the abuse dynamics that some of us are familiar with in domestic situations, domestic violence, and child abuse, the psychology behind these has actually seeped out of the home. It's never domesticated, and we are now swimming in a world, politically and socially, that is full of Cluster B personality disorder type abuse tactics. This week, we're going to talk about I'm going to show you an example of narcissistic abuse in real time, and we're going to go through a video and show exactly how somebody employs this tactic against someone else using smear campaign techniques. Then we're going to talk about something that you're going to find almost unbelievable, sympathy for the serial killer character in Silence of the Lambs from the trans community. And finally, I want to introduce you to the topic of flying monkeys. This is a slang term that's often used for the kinds of people that abusers and the personality disordered gather around them and send out into the world to co-abuse along with them. So let's just jump right into a really great example of narcissistic abuse and smear campaigns happening in real time. Let me set the stage for you because we're going to watch a video. And when we're done watching the video, I'm going to take you back through that video and I'm going to stop at key points to illustrate the exact techniques that this person is using. One thing I haven't talked about on the show yet is something called critical race theory, or CRT, critical race theory. Many of you will not have heard of that, but you will be familiar with some of the people who are behind it. Critical race theory is an outgrowth of the postmodern politics and epistemology that started up really in the 1960s with French and European intellectuals and became really the darling of the humanities departments at universities across the Western world. In a nutshell, critical race theory posits, let me explain it another way. Proponents of critical race theory, or CRT, would like you to believe that they are simply anti-racists. They want to get rid of the racism that happens in everyday interactions, but they want to get rid of what they call systemic racism or institutional racism. This is not the anti-racism of Martin Luther King Jr. So if you're watching this and you're a liberal or a person on the left, what I'd like to show you is that these people are not the heroes that you may think that they are. Martin Luther King talked about wanting to live in a world where his children were judged by the content of their character, not the color of their skin. That approach today is derided by a lot of people on the hard left, and they call it colorblindness. They make fun of people who say things like, I don't see race, I don't see sex, I don't see gender, I only see a person. They claim that this is a denial of embedded structural or institutional racism. They turn things on its head, on their head. So critical race theory, I'm not going to take a show and explain this to you. In a few minutes, I'm going to give you some resources and I'm going to suggest some places that you should go to get a deeper understanding of it. But for the purposes of what we're talking about today, this is the theory that is being propounded in American schools and in schools across many parts of the Western world. It's making its way into public school curriculums. And what it does is it posits that every institution, every philosophical system, every corporation, and every social group has racism embedded in its very fabric. Okay? This is what they mean by institutional or systemic racism. So one way to put that into a short saying, excuse me, the dry air in New England, I'm telling you folks, it doesn't do a throat good. So critical race theory says it's not whether racism manifested in a particular interaction between two people. It's how racism manifested. So understand this. In critical race theory, there is no possibility of a conversation, a corporation, or a political body that is not inherently racist. By definition, they are all inherently racist. They are all inherently asking for white supremacy. Okay. So what are we going to look at here? Couple of the players. James Lindsay is an American mathematician and university professor. He is one of the leading public intellectuals right now who has been hammering home the point that critical race theory is divisive. And it's divisive not just because it says things that people don't want to hear. It's divisive because it presupposes that every interaction we have is racist. And what it actually does is positions all white people, basically all non-black people, because these folks are starting to go for Asians now too, as fundamentally racist. This is a religion in which there is no possibility of redemption. You are born with the stain of original sin. If you are white, you are a racist, and your job as Ibram X. Kendi, whose real name is Henry Rogers, as Ibram X. Kendi says, it's not enough to not be a racist. You have to be an anti-racist. So James Lindsay has written numerous papers and blog posts. He's the co-author of a recent book called Cynical Theories with his co-author Helen Pluckrose. And Cynical Theories looks at how the postmodern intellectual philosophy has transformed into critical race theory, into transgender theory, and all of these things that we talk about on this show that manifest themselves as power grabs, basically. These are people claiming to be oppressed when in fact they have the front page of the New York Times and they have CNN tweeting about them every single day on the hour. They claim to be oppressed and they claim that it's white people or straight people or cis people who are doing this. And it is baffled, confused, and led and misdirected many genuinely decent people who think of themselves as liberals. So for his trouble, James Lindsay has been slandered across the board, both by respectable intellectuals who also have some of the same intellectual problems with this theory that James does, but they don't like it to be said quite explicitly. And I would strongly suggest that you check out James's website, which is newdiscourses.com. Newdiscourses.com. A lot of very accessible articles there on critical race theory, gender theory, and connecting these movements back to actual Marxism, actual post-structuralism, and what people today call cultural Marxism. These are words that may ding little bells in your ear, and especially if you're a liberal or on the left, you may have tensed a little bit when I said that. I realize that the reflex is to say that these things are exaggerations and they're overblown. I would have said that a couple of years ago too, but I don't believe that they are overblown. I believe that cultural Marxism is in fact real, and it is what's going on. It is what's poisoning the left. So let's take a look here. There's a bill before the New Hampshire legislature that would ban the use and teaching of critical race theory in state institutions, agencies, and public school. It doesn't use the term critical race theory, but it defines critical race theory within this bill as those things which this state will not accept being taught. This is a hearing about the bill that took place just the other day. We're going to watch the entire video, and then I'm going to come back and we're going to go through the video step by step, because it's a brilliant example of both narcissistic abuse against James Lindsay, but his performance is a masterclass in how to respond to it. So let's go right into the clip.
Thank you. Representative Schultz, you had a question?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you for taking my question. I think I know who you are. Are you the same James Lindsay that is on Twitter as @conceptualjames?
Yes, that's me.
Okay. Madam Chair, I know that this is going to be a difficult question, but I'm asking it since he claims to be a national expert and mean no offense to the committee in my question. But Mr. Lindsay, isn't it true that you have been, examined as someone who has issued death threats against the Jewish community and prominent Jewish activists?
That is not relevant to this bill.
I'll speak to that because it's false. And my name is Dr. Lindsay, if you don't mind.
And you're a math professor, correct? Not a sociology professor?
I am a PhD in mathematics who's been studying the relevant academic literature full time, 16 hours a day, most days of the week for the past 3 years.
And isn't it true you're affiliated with a national white?
Representative Schultz, I've muted you. That question.
The answer to that question is also no. I am affiliated with absolutely nothing of the sort. I can name the organization she's probably trying to insinuate bad things about to try to impugn my motives. But that organization is neither white nor nationalist. It's
Madam
in fact
Chair,
run by a half Cuban and half of its board is Asian.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I just want to say that because many of the proponents of this bill are claiming that those who oppose this are racist, isn't it important to understand, since this is all ideologically driven, if someone is actually affiliated with a group that is believed to be, by the Southern Poverty Law Center, a white supremacist group?
Representative Schultz, not necessarily. And I think we will not. I do not believe that either the supporters or the proponents of this bill are racist. And I would not make that assumption. Thank you very much.
May I have one moment to say something about that? Because it is germane.
It's germane.
Yes. So it is important to understand that one of the beliefs of critical race theory is that all criticism of critical race theory comes from a place of racism or white supremacy, whether that's intentional or unintentional. When it's unintentional, they call it willful ignorance. They suggest, and I can give you a list of citations a mile long. We could talk about Barbara Applebaum's being white, being good. We could talk about Robin DiAngelo's white fragility. We could talk about Allison Bailey's paper about privilege preserving epistemic pushback. The belief in critical race theory is that any disagreement with critical race theory must come from motives that wish to support white supremacy and racism. And in fact, they say that people who benefit from that by virtue of the color of their skin or because they are selling out if their race is other than, say, white or what they term white adjacent, have little motivation to disrupt their own racial comfort. That's their words. And therefore have a strong motivation to oppose critical race theory for self-beneficial, ultimately racist reasons that help to uphold that alleged racist white supremacy system that they claim is the ordinary operating system of society. So it's very important to understand that it's impossible to disagree with critical race theory without being accused of being a racist or a white supremacist. And you get used to it after a while.
Ooh. So again, as a reminder, this bill, which James is speaking in favor of, is a bill that would ban state institutions, local governments, the state government, and public schools, would ban them from using critical race theory. I'm going to read one section of the bill out to you, and please listen to this carefully. Just listen to these words, and they will tell you what this bill is about. And you may have questions about why Representative Schultz is opposing this bill. So, here's Here's the relevant section of the bill. The contractor, and in context here, the contractor basically means the person working on behalf of the state, shall not use any workplace training that inculcates into its employees any form of race or sex stereotyping or any form of race or sex scapegoating, including the concepts that A, one race or sex is inherently superior to another race or sex, B, an individual, by virtue of his or her race or sex, is inherently racist, sexist, or oppressive, whether consciously or unconsciously. C, an individual should be discriminated against or receive adverse treatment solely or partly because of his or her race or sex. D, members of one race or sex cannot and should not attempt to treat others without respect to race or sex. E, an individual's moral character is necessarily determined by his or her race or sex. F, an individual, by virtue of his or her race or sex, bears responsibility for actions committed in the past by other members of the same race or sex. This has to do with white guilt and white people today being responsible for the slavery that some of their forebears engaged in. G, any individual should feel discomfort, guilt, anguish, or any other form of psychological distress on account of his or her race or sex. Or H, meritocracy or traits such as a hard work ethic are racist or sexist or were created by a particular race to oppress another race. I'm going to end with that there. Folks, this is a bill that is anti-racist and anti-sexist. This bill says that you may not come into the state and take money or work on behalf of the state and tell anybody that you're working with that because they were born black, they have a certain moral character, because they were born white, they have a certain moral character, or because they were born as a man or a woman. This is liberal. This is a traditional liberal humanitarian bill that says that you may not psychologically abuse or inculcate people on behalf of the state into the belief that simply being born white or black, male or female, is a stain on your character or transfers onto you the sins of your ancestors. I'm guessing that those of you watching and listening who are liberals agree with this. I agree with this. Many people on the right agree with this. Most people on the right agree with this. This is a fundamentally egalitarian idea. It's not a partisan issue. It's not a lefty bill. It's not a righty bill. Okay? Representative Schultz, who goes after James Lindsay, is against this bill because she wants critical race theory to be taught. She wants people to have the opportunity to tell children in schools that they need to examine their whiteness and be less white. And yes, this is from real examples. These people who claim to be on your side, liberals and lefties, they're the racists. They are the racists. Let's revisit that video clip because it's just a goldmine of how narcissistic abuse works. You've heard the term narcissistic abuse, many of you, and like some other terms of art that get thrown around, you may have that initial reaction, oh, everybody says everyone's a narcissist now. Everyone who gets upset says it's narcissistic abuse. I understand, but I'm going to pull this back into reality here, because regardless of the excesses, frankly, of narcissists, these are real concepts, okay? I've talked in past shows about some of the examples of child abuse that my siblings and I suffered at the hands of my mother. What my mother did to us was classic narcissistic abuse, okay? It's child abuse, but it's also narcissistic abuse because my mother is a clinical narcissist and a clinical borderline. This is very, very common. This is what people with cluster B personality disorders do, and it's what people who have been co-opted by people with cluster B personalities do. So the first instance I want to show you, and if you don't actually have a notebook, this would be a good time to get one. If you're interested in being able to forensically examine how this is done in real time, this is a really good time to take notes. So let's start with the first video bit.
Thank you. Representative Schultz, you had a question?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you for taking my question. I think I know who you are. Are you the same James Lindsay that is on Twitter as @conceptualjames?
I think I know who you are. Starts right off the bat. False innocence. Okay? The purpose of what she did right there was to make sure that people heard slowly and clearly what James Lindsay's Twitter handle is. And I'm going to indulge in a bit of mind reading here, but it's a really good educated guess. She wants people to remember that so that they can go on Twitter and add to the thousands of people who are abusing him and calling him a racist. This had nothing to do with clarifying who he was. She wanted to make sure that on the record, in a public forum, people knew how to find him. That's what that is. Let's go on to clip two.
Mr. Lindsay, isn't it true that you have been, examined as someone who has issued death threats against the Jewish community and prominent Jewish activists?
I'm not even sure what to call that. Well, poisoning isn't quite strong enough. It's character assassination. Aren't you someone who has been examined as someone who has issued death threats against the Jewish community? In case this isn't clear, folks, James Lindsay has issued no death threats against anyone. If you can find evidence of this, please send it to me, us@disaffected.fm, us@disaffected.fm. I won't be receiving any emails from you about this, of course, because it didn't happen. And notice how she does it. She's trying to give herself plausible deniability, but she's not the most clever at it that I've seen before. Isn't it true that you have been examined? Notice the work the passive voice is doing there. What she's saying is, isn't it true that people say this about you? Isn't this true? Well, poisoning, character assassination, and outsourcing her accusations onto other people so that she doesn't have to say them under her own name, supposedly. It's just that this is what people are saying. If it feels like high school to you, that's because this is high school behavior. Remember, a lot of people who use personality disorder abuse tactics are emotionally stunted. One way to describe cluster B personality disorders is arrested emotional development. That's why you see that some of them quite literally throw tantrums like toddlers because they are emotionally stuck at the toddler stage. Others of them sound like nasty teenagers because that is actually when their emotional maturation stopped. That's why you see this. Let's go to the next one. This one's one of my favorites.
And you're a math professor, correct? Not a sociology professor?
Do you recognize that from a couple episodes ago? That's don't diagnose. Don't diagnose. You're a math professor, right? Not a sociology professor? So you don't know what you're talking about, right? This is don't diagnose, just in another form. But is Representative Schultz looking around at her colleagues in the New Hampshire legislature and asking them if they are sociology professors? Don't they need a sociology degree in order to comment on this bill or even to propose it? Of course not, because that's not what this is about. She wants James to shut up. Don't diagnose and shut up. Stop connecting the dots. Stop pulling the wool off of people's eyes and stop pulling the curtain back. That's what she's doing. Next one.
True, you're affiliated with a national white.
Okay. The chair cut that off, but it's clear to everybody that she was saying, isn't it true that you are affiliated with a national white supremacist organization? This is actual slander by the legal definition, not slander used casually. This meets the legal definition, in my opinion, of slander. And she's repeated some of this stuff in writing on Twitter, which qualifies it legally as libel. So were I James Lindsay, you know, I I would be justified in speaking to a lawyer about this on the grounds of slander and libel. Whether or not, sorry about that, folks, whether or not he does that is another issue. Sometimes, regardless of how flagrantly someone violates the law that way, going forward with litigation is not the best tactical option. So I don't make any judgment on that, but I want you to see this. This is how confident these people are. This is an elected representative, and I guess I should stir that in a little bit. She probably has some form of immunity or qualified immunity because she's speaking as an elected representative. But if I understand that correctly, that's even more appalling. That's simply an abuse of power. That is outrageous. Let's go to the next one.
I just want to say that because many of the proponents of this bill are claiming that those who oppose this are racist, isn't it important to understand, since this is all ideologically driven, if someone is actually affiliated with a group that is believed to be, by the Southern Poverty Law Center, a white supremacist group?
Again, notice how she's outsourcing her accusations to other people to give herself plausible deniability. Well, if other people are saying he is a racist, and if organizations that I assume you respect, like the Southern Poverty Law Center, say that he's a racist, well, isn't it important for us to examine? I don't know. I don't know if he's a racist. I only know that the Southern Poverty Law Center says that he is a racist. I've been involved with litigation, because it sounds a little bit like a courtroom. I've been involved in big time litigation, both as a named plaintiff on behalf of an organization that I worked for, and as a witness who's been deposed. Probably the longest time I spent was two entire days, 8 to 10 hour days, being deposed by a battery of corporate lawyers. And this is the kind of bullshit they pull, right? She's trying to impugn his character, but she's trying to do it in a way that borrows the legitimacy of other organizations. And the Southern Poverty Law Center, again, gonna be a little bit bracing if this is new to you as a leftist or a liberal, but that organization is as much of a moral shit show as the American Civil Liberties Union. Morris Dees, the founder, with his project, looks more to me like a self-aggrandizing narcissist than an actual crusader against injustice. And the SPLC makes up list after list after list of hate organizations and propaganda organizations. I mean, they have labeled organizations that have stood up for women's rights against trans incursions, like laws that would allow boys to go into the girls' locker room. They call these groups of women hate groups, and they do the same thing in other ways. So I don't really care what the Southern Poverty Law Center has to say, but she knows, Representative Schultz knows, that people hear SPLC, and if they're liberals who haven't examined this or haven't heard about this yet, they understand that she understands that they put moral stock in them. And so this will sound alarming. She knows exactly what she's doing. And are we off to the last one? Okay, yep. This is the last clip here. And this is a really good example of how you meet a narcissistic smear campaign when it comes up to you. Okay? James Lindsay's response is a masterclass. Notice when you watch this that he responds factually, but maybe even more importantly, notice the lack of emotion. Notice that he's not using hyperbolic language. He's not throwing himself all over the place. He's modulating his tone of voice. He is very wisely underplaying this woman. Okay?
So it is important to understand that one of the beliefs of critical race theory is that all criticism of critical race theory comes from a place of racism or white supremacy, whether that's intentional or unintentional. When it's unintentional, they call it willful ignorance. They suggest, and I can give you a list of citations a mile long. We could talk about Barbara Applebaum's being white, being good. We could talk about Robin DiAngelo's white fragility. We could talk about Allison Bailey's paper about privilege preserving epistemic pushback. The belief in critical race theory is that any disagreement with critical race theory must come from motives that wish to support white supremacy and racism. And in fact, they say that people who benefit from that by virtue of the color of their skin or because they are selling out if their race is other than, say, white or what they term white adjacent, have little motivation to disrupt their own racial comfort. That's their words. And therefore have a strong motivation to oppose critical race theory for self-beneficial, ultimately racist reasons that help to uphold that alleged racist white supremacy system that they claim is the ordinary operating system of society. So it's very important to understand that it's impossible to disagree with critical race theory without being accused of being a racist or a white supremacist. And you get used to it after a while.
That you do. If you are the target of a smear campaign of any type, whether it's in a small group of people or whether it's in front of an elected body like this one, try to take that approach. It's taken me a very long time to learn that, and it's been difficult for me, as I've said in past shows. I have histrionic tendencies myself. Some topics are emotionally very under the surface for me, and it's taken me until I've gotten into my mid to late 40s to be able to calm down enough to remember not to react in kind to people like this. So if somebody is lobbing histrionic complaints at you, using a lot of hyperbole, trying to assassinate your character, those of us who have an immediate defensive reflexive reaction are tempted to respond in kind and to get as loud or louder, and that's a mistake. When you have a narcissist or a histrionic, you have to underplay them, okay? It's actually, I mean, speaking of narcissists and histrionics, it reminds me of an acting choice that Joan Crawford made in the 60s when she teamed up with her arch rival Bette Davis to make the classic horror film Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. Bette Davis's character in that is completely histrionic and over the top, both the makeup, the appearance, the mannerism. She's the villain. And Joan Crawford plays her crippled sister, bound up in a wheelchair and former movie star. And one of the reviewers, because Joan herself was known for over the top acting, not the same kind as Bette Davis, but her own brand. And one of the critics said Crawford very wisely underplayed Davis's character and thereby gained a lot of sympathy and sort of became the real hero of the story because she didn't rise to that level. She just she underplayed. So underplay. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about sympathy for the devil and the trans community trying to rehabilitate the image of a fictional serial killer and crossdresser from Silence of the Lambs. Come back and have fun. Welcome back. One of the things I've noticed in recent years is the cultural left's attempts to rehabilitate the monstrous into something joyful or lovely or something to aspire to. And there's no better example of that than how the trans activists on the left have approached the classic film, The Silence of the Lambs. I was kind of thinking, how do I prepare you folks for this segment? Because some of the things I'm going to say, I'm going to quote about this are so unbelievable that you would think this is parody, but this is not parody. This article that I'm going to talk about, written by a trans woman about Silence of the Lambs, is the second such article I've seen from a trans woman trying to rehabilitate the character of the serial killer Buffalo Bill from the movie. So for those of you who have not seen the movie or who don't remember it very well, The Silence of the Lambs was a 1991 film, American film, starring Jodie Foster and Anthony Hopkins. Jodie Foster plays Clarice Starling, an FBI agent who's tracking a serial killer. Anthony Hopkins plays the famous character Dr. Hannibal Lecter, a narcissistic psychopath, and I believe was a psychologist or psychiatrist, that Jodie Foster's character, the FBI agent Clarice, turns to for insight into how to track this killer who has abducted a young woman, and he wants to make a skin suit out of her. So it's a psychological thriller. It's quite disturbing. And the character Buffalo Bill, whose real name in the movie was James Gumb, is a cross-dressing paraphiliac. One of the things that people don't like to talk about that criminologists know is true, and you don't have to believe me, and you shouldn't believe anything I say just because I say it. You can go into the literature and confirm this for yourself. Among violent criminals, violent male criminals, cross-dressing is one of the most common paraphilias among them. There is, in fact, a connection between fetishistic cross-dressing among male criminals, fetishistic cross-dressing and male criminality, particularly among serial killers. This is not transphobic. It's not made up. It's not a stereotype that came from nowhere. It is something well known in criminology. This is fact, however unpleasant that fact may be. So Buffalo Bill, the transsexual character in the film, abducts a young woman and puts her in the bottom of a stone well. And his eventual goal is to kill her and to make a literal skin suit out of her that he can wear. He wants to become her by making a skin suit. So that's where you get the famous line, it puts the lotion in the basket. He puts lotion, hand lotion, body lotion, in a basket and lowers it on a rope in a basket. Sorry, a lot of things that aren't funny are really funny. Down into a well for this poor abducted woman, and says, it puts the lotion on its skin or else it gets the hose again. She has to soften her own skin up. It's like the Hansel and Gretel story where the two children get caught in the candy cottage with the witch, and she puts them in cages and feeds them and feeds them and feeds them to fatten them up so that they'll make a juicy roast. So we're talking about a psychopathic killer here, okay? And the character of Buffalo Bill was based on several real-life serial killers, one of whom was Ed Gein or Gein. I don't know which is the correct pronunciation. His last name is spelled G-E-I-N. So he's a composite character that's drawn from some real-life serial killers. Let me read you a couple of quotations from this article written on the 30th anniversary of the film's release by somebody named Harmony Colangelo. I have no idea who this person is, except that it's a man who calls himself a trans woman. The Silence of the Lambs is celebrating its 30th anniversary this year, and after 3 decades of unhappy marriage to this film, I will not miss an opportunity to gripe about the old ball and chain. Wordplay aside, there is no film I hate more than The Silence of the Lambs. Those feelings have evolved over the years from not understanding the jokes about tucking that my family would make at the expense of a trans woman in my neighborhood. Breaking out here a little bit, tucking means what it sounds like. It's tucking the penis and scrotum back between the legs. It's a trick that some drag performers do to give the appearance of a smooth crotch, you know, as if there were a vulva underneath there instead of a dick and balls. At the expense of a trans woman in my neighborhood, to not understanding the hype of how terrifying Buffalo Bill was in my teens. And I did the air quotes here because he actually put quotes around terrifying. He is claiming that to see the serial killer in this movie as terrifying is ridiculous and is based only on transphobia. I don't know about you, but if there were somebody I knew of who was kidnapping women and putting them in the bottom of stone wells and making them put lotion on so they'd make a really soft skin suit, I'd be pretty fucking terrified myself. Are you getting a window into the mindset of these people yet? Despite insistence from the film's text that it is not transphobic, the countless experiences directly referencing this film that I've had over the 11 plus years that I've been out as trans beg to differ. We're talking about a woman here. Do you see? Do you see? I just said a woman. This is what pronouns and respect their new names and don't name, dead name them leads to. Even people like me who can see through this bullshit are psychologically primed this way. Notice that mistake that I just made. You're making it too, I guarantee it. This is a person who is identifying with this character. Right before I started this show today, I went back to confirm the title of this article, and I wish I had screenshotted it because it has changed since I saw it 2 days ago. I don't remember what the original title was, but it had something to do with even Buffalo Bill deserves to have her gender respected. That's not the title anymore. unbelievable. These people are retconning history right in front of us on the fly. The new title is A Reluctant Defense. I guess that's not the title. They're very confusing here. The new title, 30 Years In, the Silence of the Lambs' Jame Gumm Still Deserves Better. Jame Gumm is the supposedly real name of the character named Buffalo Bill. That's bad enough. 30 years in, Jame Gumm still deserves better? First of all, we're talking about a fictional character here. And notice this also. Notice these people's inability to separate real life from fiction. I talked in a prior episode about the mask of the narcissist. That's what this is. These people really do personally identify with these fictional characters. They are, in some sense, real to them in a way that to normal people like you and I are not real at all. This is the false self, the mask of the narcissist as the real. They are so strongly, they have such a blurred boundary between reality and fiction that, well, I mean, it's just a blurry line. It's very disturbing to see. Let me give you a couple more quotes here. The entire argument that the Silence of the Lambs is not transphobic rests on a single conversation between Hannibal Lecter and Clarice Starling when the two meet to discuss the modus operandi of Jame Gumm, a.k.a. Buffalo Bill, after a senator's daughter is abducted. Clarice points out the lack of correlation between trans people and violence, to which Lecter retorts that Billy, Buffalo Bill, is not a real transsexual. He also mentions that there are, quote, three major centers for transsexual surgery, end quote. And the first on the list is Johns Hopkins Hospital, one of the most influential and respected medical facilities on the planet. Not to try and beat Hannibal Lecter at his own game, but he should know that Johns Hopkins ceased gender-affirming care in 1979. Gender-affirming care? Do you know what that's a euphemism for? I'll give you a couple of seconds to write your answer down and see if you're right. Gender-affirming care is the current euphemism for castration. It's the current euphemism for cutting open the scrotum, getting rid of the testicles, slicing open the penis, and inverting it to create a faux vagina, which is actually merely a dead-end flesh pocket. That's what it is. And yes, Johns Hopkins did cease castration and vaginoplasty in 1979, because Paul McHugh, the head psychiatrist of Johns Hopkins for decades at the time, correctly noted that this was psychiatry colluding with and identifying with a mental illness. His research and research from some of his colleagues convinced him, and I agree with this, there is no such thing as being a transsexual. There's no person who's actually born in the wrong body. There are people who believe they are, and there are people who are in severe distress from that delusional belief. Just as there are people who are in severe distress because they deludedly believe that they're Napoleon Bonaparte, or they believe that they are the Messiah reincarnated. Yeah, this is a little challenging, isn't it? If you're a new viewer and you're used to being sympathetic to trans people who say, I just want to go on with my life, I was just born in the wrong body. Yeah, I realize that this jolts you a little bit and it sounds mean, doesn't it? It's not mean about these people. These people are suffering and they do need care, but they're not suffering because they were born in the wrong body. And the care they need is not to have their genitals literally mutilated and turned into a facsimile of a woman. I mean, the fact that we have to have this conversation today shows the kind of insanity that is going on here. And this is what Harmony calls gender-affirming care. What Harmony doesn't tell you in the article is that after Paul McHugh retired, Johns Hopkins hopped back on the gravy train in 2017 and restarted gender-affirming care. That was a political decision, not a scientific one, and certainly not a compassionate one. Yeah, I'm angry about this. I'm angry about it. I'm angry about it because it's gaslighting. It's rewriting reality. It's taking what is a frankly and obviously psychopathic surgical approach to a problem of suffering that exists in the mind. The fact that these doctors and surgeons can hold themselves up as heroes for people, even children these days, you know, finally helping them, you know, relieve their distress by slicing up their genitals and poisoning their bodies with cross-sex hormones that are going to leave them sterile, with elevated rates of cancer and heart disease and pathological physical changes to their body. It enrages me that this is going on, and it disturbs me and it frightens me that so many people on the compassionate left are buying this stuff without looking into it. If nobody has ever talked to you this frankly and this graphically about what trans is, then you're overdue. And thank you for listening, because you need to think about this and you need to stop reflexively applauding this stuff. It's not care, it's cruelty. It's monetized psychopathy. Let me give you a little bit more. Ah, yes, here we go. The author goes on and says, talking about Jonathan Demme, the director of the film, who's responded to criticism over the years somewhat like this, but from other corners as well. Harmony writes, after more than two decades of criticism, he, Jonathan Demme, never really got it, and the olive branch he tried to extend to the queer community with his follow-up, Philadelphia, a 1993 movie starring Tom Hanks, and I can't for the life of me remember, was it Denzel Washington? The other actor in there about a man with AIDS. That means little when he was not able to understand the innate transphobia of The Silence of the Lambs. Admitting his shortcomings and not making it clear that Gum wasn't gay doesn't dissolve the damage done by the film. In the same way that Hannibal Lecter saying Billy isn't trans while actually describing what gender dysphoria is doesn't negate the portrayal in the film itself. This is a good opportunity to introduce you to the concept of autogynephilia. Vitamin Vegemin. I felt like I was doing the Lucy commercial. Autogynephilia. Autogynephilia is part of a theory developed by the sex researcher Kenneth Zucker. So you can go look this up online. And it breaks down the men who claim that they are women born in the wrong body and they want to transition to female into two major categories. The first category is the homosexual. Okay. And this is somebody that we gay people all recognize from decades ago at the bars and in our community. These are gay men who are extraordinarily effeminate, much more so than even the typical gay guy. And yeah, the typical gay guy, and I'm included here, does have effeminate mannerisms. Some of them are very mild. There are some gay men that you don't see them in at all, but that stereotype is not just pulled out of thin air. It's obvious just listening to me talk. I'm not that different from most gay men. So an extraordinarily effeminate homosexual who believes that he was born in the wrong body and he should have been a girl. And this is the type of guy, this is a tortured soul, okay? This is a tortured soul. This is somebody who needs compassion, who's not getting it from the current treatment regime. These are the people who would actually go through with, some form of sex change, what we called sex change surgery. A lot of them merely had false breasts implanted, but some of them went the full way and had downstairs done too. This is like what I talked about on a recent episode. This is a manifestation, in most cases, of very severe borderline personality disorder. Remember how I told you that one of the diagnostic criteria of borderline personality disorder is a warped and unstable self-image and self-identity. There's nothing more unstable or pathological than a belief that you are truly a woman trapped in a man's body and that the only way to live healthfully and happily is to have grossly mutilating surgery. That's not normal. That's not natural. It makes no sense to say that people are born this way. Where this comes from is trauma and abuse. Most gay men and lesbians come from trauma and abuse. Just look at your gay friends. Talk to them. talk about their family backgrounds. Almost all of them come from a background of child abuse and domestic violence. Fact. Some worse than others. And the damage that is done, all of us carry it, and some worse than others. So that's the first type of autogynephile. The second type, or the first type of transsexual, excuse me. The second type is the autogynephile. And that's Greek, and it simply means love of the self as a woman. These are men, usually heterosexual men. Did you know that most of the so-called self-identifying trans women today are not actually gay men? They're heterosexual men. They're attracted to women. Most of them. So if you think that trans women means that soft, sissy, effeminate gay boy that you remember from high school who was very sweet and who you took into your club of female friends and protected him from the bullies, that guy exists, right? We all know him. That's not most trans these days. Most of them are straight men. They're autogynephiles. They have an erotic obsession with seeing themselves as a woman. They get sexual gratification from imagining themselves as a woman, and usually in a compromising, submissive, almost rape-like position vis-a-vis men and sexuality. They go online and they talk about how they want to be sissified. They want to be bimboed up by a real man and made to be a slave to cock. Yeah, I know it's gross and it's rampant. Go online. If you don't believe me, look it up. You'll come back and say you were right. These autogynephiles, that's what so many of them are. And it should not be a stretch. It isn't the case that all or even most trans women are serial killers. That would obviously be ridiculous. I'm not saying that. But there is a psychological and a psychiatric connection between this kind of personality disorder and the disturbed identity and erotic fixations that often come up as a symptom of these personality disorders, which are rooted in childhood trauma most of the time. Let's see, is there another one in here that we want to get to? This delusion. Within the film, James Gum, Buffalo Bill, was created by a system that did everything it could to fail them. There is a reflection of this in the filmmaker, who seemingly took every measure to make James Gum wholly unsympathetic in a film that is supposed to be about criminal profiling and the psychology of a killer. Does it take any effort to make a psychosexual serial killer and possible cannibal unsympathetic? Let me read that to you again. Within the film, Buffalo Bill was created by a system that did everything it could to fail them. The them is supposed to be him. There is a reflection of this in the filmmakers, who seemingly took every measure to make Jamie Gum wholly unsympathetic in a film that is supposed to be about criminal profiling and the psychology of a killer. This is deranged. This is utterly deranged. This is suggesting that we should find this character sympathetic. This goes back to what I talked about recently, that explanations are not excuses. There are explanations for the psychological and moral development of people who turn out like this, whether they be fictional characters that are based on real life or real life examples. Yes, it is true that severe child abuse and a distorted upbringing is often, even usually, found in the background of people like this. But of course, there are millions of us out there who had abusive childhoods who didn't turn out to be nearly as fucked up as this. I'm one of them. Fucked up in my own way, but, you know, I'm not telling you to put the lotion on your skin. I mean, you can do that or not. It's up to you. This is written in a publication that's playing it straight. I should have done this at the beginning, but this is in avclub.com, Audiovisual Club, AV Club, which is a division of The Onion. You know The Onion is the American satirical newspaper, but the AV Club is actually legit straight criticism of film and video. This is mainstream cultural left publication here, okay? This is not a fringe article, or it's not a fringe magazine. It's not a little zine done by college students. This is mainstream bread and butter, mainstream leftist culture. This is how deranged it has gotten. I'm going to leave you with one final quote from this before we end this segment. But after all the history and context, what I hate most is how I have to defend Jane Gumm despite everything in me not wanting to. My life and how I've been treated has been directly affected by this film, and I want nothing more than to flippantly write them off and move on. Maybe make some jokes about tucking, laughing at the camp of cheap shoes and fava beans, and even trying to reclaim the film like I have seen some other queer people do. But I can't. This is a character that doesn't even get the dignity of their gender being acknowledged at the time or in the years since. Billy isn't a real transsexual, but he thinks he is. If Billy thinks he's trans, that means they are trans. And that, my friends, is the international auditory symbol of borderline personality disorder. So when you hear the chimes, think BPD. This is deranged. This is sick. If Billy thinks they are trans, that means they are trans. Unbelievable. Come back for the next segment. Welcome back. I want to close the show out today by talking about a concept called flying monkeys or flying monkeyism. Some of you will know the term. It's a slang term that is used to describe the people whom cluster B personality disorder types, narcissists, borderlines, histrionics, sociopaths, the people that they co-opt to do their dirty work for them. And it comes, of course, from the classic film, The Wizard of Oz. The Wicked Witch of the West had an army of literal flying monkeys that she sent out to go after Dorothy and the Tin Man and the Cowardly Lion and the Scarecrow. So you'll often see people describing others as being flying monkeys. And flying monkeyism is something that can happen to all of us. I've been my mother's flying monkey. For years, my mother had me convinced that it was my sister who was crazy, not anyone else. And I was so under my mother's thumb that I just parroted whatever she did. And I interpreted anything my sister said as evidence of her craziness. But of course, my sister and I are very close now and we don't speak to my mother. We thankfully were able to reconnect as adults. And we worked together, actually, 5 years ago. We helped bring each other to enlightenment about my mother's personality disorder and realized that the view that my sister and I had of each other was a warped and distorted view that came from a pathological liar. But you will often see this in family situations when people who, outside of the sphere of the narcissist or the abuser, are not actually abusive people themselves. They're not actually personality disordered themselves. They're co-abusers. They've been made into flying monkeys. I'm going to put an image up here for a little warning I got on Facebook because it illustrates a form of flying monkeyism. So I was looking at a post by, I guess, an underwear company called Moleky. I mean, I don't know why there are so many underwear companies out there today, but I guess there are. They're a very woke company, and they use trans women models, and, you know, everybody is accepted, everybody's beautiful. They're basically, do you remember underoos? You remember, like, Super Friends, Batman and Robin, Superman? Remember the underwear you could get that was, like, when I was a kid, I had Batman pajamas, but I also had Robin pajamas. Absolutely loved them. Any of you who grew up in the 70s and 80s will remember these. They basically make these things. So I'm not going to show you a picture, but I'll just describe it. They were showing Emily, a young man who appeared to be maybe 19 or 20 years old, modeling basically a Wonder Woman bra and panty set, okay? The sort of winsome smile, you know. The head tilt. That's how you know it's a trans woman, by the way. Head tilt like this. And not only did it look silly, it bordered on the pedophilic because this young man, and I'm assuming he was of age, nearly hairless, posed in a way that suggested sexual availability, very much the way they make girls and women pose. You know, they can never stand up straight. They have to be leaning on one hip or having, you know, one hip forward and, you know, sort of being like this, you know, come take me. And how do I explain this? Because I know all of you know the same thing too. You know, when you're looking at underwear advertisements or the packaging, you're looking at how the model presents all this stuff, and you've all noticed the same thing. You notice that art directors are very careful not to show female nipples through the outline of the bra cup, and they're also careful not to show details of the line of the penis or the scrotum in men's briefs. You know, you'll see the curve, the natural bulge, but they sort of airbrush out the details that would show the head of the penis or the actual testicles. Not this company. This, you know, Emily posing there in the Wonder Woman bra and panty set. It was so obvious to me that they didn't Photoshop this. Just, it's so hard to describe, but trust me, it looked pedophilic. You could see his penis and testicles, but it was a very youthful, sexualized image. Just creepy. Really, really creepy. And of course, a whole number of commenters, mostly women, you know, women who are fed up with being told that this is who they are, you know, that men are better women than them or that men are women at all, were taking them to task quite rightly on this and talking about what bullshit it was and how damaging it was, not only to the models they're using, but to the young women out there who are caught up in this social justice crap and stand there applauding for all of this drag nonsense. And like these companies always do, because this is deliberate, they then had to say, "We are so saddened and outraged by the hate coming from people on our post, and we're just here to make people feel good about their authentic selves. And why don't you all get a better hobby than trying to invalidate trans women?" So because I'm snotty and I can't keep my mouth shut, I said, "Please find a better hobby than calling mentally unwell men women." Somebody has to say it, because a whole bunch of people aren't saying it. Facebook, because of, and I know this is going to happen. It's not like I'm surprised or, you know, anything like that. But, you know, all these, you know, trans women behind their keys. Trans women, I'm going to report him. I'm going to report him. Well, they reported me. And this is what Facebook sent back. And I'm sure some of you have seen these warnings, too, against violating community standards. But I want you to look at this language carefully. "Your comment goes against our community standards on hate speech and inferiority." Notice that word, inferiority. "No one else can see your comment. We have these standards to protect certain groups of people being described as inferior to others." Kafka. Kafka, Orwell, and Huxley. The inferiority is new language. I've had dozens of Facebook bans. I've been banned for 3 days. I've been banned for a month. I've been banned for a week, countless times. I've never seen the inferiority before. This is a form of flying monkeyism, okay? This is Facebook helping out this project of silencing criticism against this dangerous and harmful nonsense. They are carrying water and flapping through the air back to the Wicked Witch's castle after they poisoned Dorothy. They are cooperating and making sure that people get shut down and that they don't see what you have to say about this. And no, I don't care that what I said was snotty and snarky. Yes, it was snotty and snarky. It's not hate speech. It's not hate speech. And they know it. You know it. Everyone listening and watching knows it. But I am disturbed, actually, by this language creep. "We have these standards to protect certain groups of people being described as inferior to others." This is what moral and cultural relativism is. This is saying that it is illegitimate and a form of violence and a form of discrimination to compare, to say one is better than another, one does a better job than another, one is smarter than another, one is prettier than another. They want to flatten this all out because this is the only way that mediocre people and, quite frankly, flagrantly psychiatrically ill people can participate in the delusion that they are just as mentally sound as the rest of us, And I'm not saying that to be cruel. I'm not saying these people should be harmed. They shouldn't be thrown out of their jobs. They shouldn't be subject to legal discrimination. I'm not advocating any of that. But these people are psychiatrically sick. And their psychiatric sickness is making the rest of us mentally unwell because we are living in a world of gaslighting where water is being described as wet, where we are being told that when the sun comes out, that means it's dark on the earth. I mean, it's absolutely ludicrous. It's getting worse. This is language creep. So flying monkeys. Some of you may have heard the recent cancel fest over the Disney and Star Wars former star Gina Carano. I haven't watched this show, but there's a popular show on the Disney Plus network called The Mandalorian, which is a spinoff from the Star Wars universe. And Gina Carano is one of the stars of the show who's been fired for things that she's tweeted and put on Facebook, on social media. So here are a couple of Gina Carano's sins, and you should really look her up. She's a conservative, which is why she's being blacklisted in Hollywood now, and she's kept her mouth shut for a long time. Listen to the stuff that put it over the top for these lefties who've now fired her from the show. One of her social media posts said this, and it was accompanied by a classic picture, I believe, from World War II. I think it may also have been an album cover, showing a woman in what they used to call a foundation garment, a girdle with garters and stockings. It appeared that she'd been stripped and she was running down the street in terror while children threw rocks at her. It looks like a picture from World War II. So Gina says, Jews were beaten in the streets, not by Nazi soldiers, but by their neighbors, even children. Because history is edited, most people today don't realize that to get to the point where Nazi soldiers could easily round up thousands of Jews, the government first made their own neighbors hate them simply for being Jews. How is that any different from hating someone for their political views? Well, that was a big sin, and that got her accusations of trivializing the Holocaust and saying that conservatives were just as oppressed as Jews being put in the gas chambers. It's patent nonsense, and they know it's nonsense. Comparisons like this are legitimate. We all use them every single day to get points across. Human beings learn and communicate by the use of analogy and comparison. The other thing that probably got her in trouble, because like most upstanding and reasonable people who haven't bought into this bullshit, Gina Carano refuses to put her pronouns in her Twitter bio. And when somebody pushed her on that, she put, my pronouns are beep, bop, boop. And I assume that that was an inside Star Wars joke, a reference to droids like R2-D2 making beeps and boops. It's cute and funny, right? No, it's hate speech. So now she's canceled. And because she's canceled, she's teaming up with Ben Shapiro, cultural commentator, and one of the publications he's associated with to make a film about these issues. So I wish her the best of luck, and we'll keep track of what's going on with Gina. Another example of flying monkeys, why this is so important. One of the criticisms that people like me get is it's a straw man. It's a caricature. People will say, Josh just thinks everybody's personality disordered, or every time Josh disagrees with somebody, he says that they have a cluster B personality disorder. Obviously, that's not true. This is a way what that means is shut up, shut up, shut up. I don't think everybody has a personality disorder. I'm not that unintelligent. I'm not that unobservant. Most people don't have a personality disorder. If most people had it, we wouldn't call it a disorder. Although I don't know what we're going to do because more and more people seem to be getting them. Most people aren't personality disordered. Most people aren't cluster B. But most people are vulnerable to narcissistic manipulation. Most people are vulnerable to becoming co-opted as a flying monkey. I've been a flying monkey. Many of you listening to me and watching me right now have been flying monkeys. I'm not proud of it, but it's something that you do before you are old enough, wise enough, and with enough experience to understand how you're being used and to cease cooperating with it. I saw another example of what I think I'd call malignant flying monkeyism on Facebook recently. And actually, it had to do with Gina Carano. Long thread about Gina Carano and her response. And people were saying, you know, it's ridiculous. She should get fired for this. But there are a whole bunch of wokesters who came in and said, you know, yeah, it is. And here's one of them. I may not understand the use of pronouns. I may even disagree. But if it is required by my employer to add them to my profile, my social media profile, especially when it's public, I do it. I don't mock it and act like a child. Listen to me, children. I'm the wise, mature adult. When someone tells me to jump off a cliff, I don't question it. I do it. And I don't act like a child and cry about it. That's not being a grown-up. That's being a flying monkey. And scolding other people for not being a flying monkey along with you. And shortly after that, I saw another Facebook friend, a gay man, who agrees with a lot of my point of view on what's wrong with transgenderism. And I don't want to criticize him. I'm going to criticize him. But it's I don't have any malignant feelings towards this guy. I think he's deeply confused and misguided, and in ways that I have been confused and misguided. I would have said the things that he now says, but 5 or 6 years ago. Where I lose my patience with people like him, and there are many of them, is that they've had well long enough to learn the truth by now. They have had their nose rubbed in the abuse, the firings, and the bannings from social media. They've seen it happen to their friends, particularly to lesbians who can't find a bar in the whole goddamn United States now because they're all queer places that throw lesbians out if they say no to penis. My friend has had long enough to learn better. And like many people, my guess here is that he came from a traumatic and abusive background, as so many gay people do. And he is still a codependent. He's still an enabler. He thinks that he can finally get these people to respect him or listen to him, and frankly, although he wouldn't say so, to love him, if he just cooperates the right way. He's wrong. I understand where he is, but my sympathy has an end point because he's now cooperating with him. He's being a flying monkey for this project. And he was chastising people about not using the correct pronouns for people. And his thesis was, you know, just as I wouldn't call someone a slur, I wouldn't call someone a TERF, trans-exclusionary radical feminist. So you shouldn't misgender people because it's just alienating and not productive to the conversation. No. No. Using slurs against people to shut them up is not the same thing as refusing to lie about the sex of somebody else. We are way past the point where we can tell polite lies in private and call our trans women friends she just because they're really nice and don't hurt a fly. As somebody on Twitter said, it was Abigail Schreier, actually, the author of the great new book Irreversible Damage, about the damage that the trans industry is doing to young girls who are transing as minors. Everybody should get this book and read it, Irreversible Damage. Abigail Schreier said, the polite lies we tell in private have now metastasized into public. This is a paraphrase, not a direct quote, but it's close. We have to stop this now. We're way past this point. And I agree with her. Respecting pronouns is not about politeness. It's about compliance. And when you object to people saying this stuff, they say, there's no need for me to antagonize my friends. And I understand that. I've been in situations, and I'll be in situations again, where there's somebody who says that they're trans. And the most practical thing I can do in the moment is not to refer to them as their natal sex. But I want to tell you something. I do it under duress. If you are ever in a room with me and you hear me using the proper pronouns for someone, it's because I don't have any other choice. I'm doing it under duress, and I want you to know that. I don't believe what I'm saying. I'm doing it because I have to comply or I'm going to face consequences. I'm either going to be thrown out of the room. I'm going to be lectured. Somebody's going to call my employer again. I do it under duress and I resent it. Flying monkeyism can get much worse. And I'll close today by telling you a story about my mother's husband, who is one of the most malignant flying monkeys I've ever known. If you haven't listened to earlier episodes and you want to understand why I talk about child abuse, domestic abuse, and cluster B personality disorders, go back and listen to the original episode, Mommy Issues, the origin story. That's where I tell a little bit more detail about my mother, the borderline and the narcissist, and her behavior, both in my childhood and when she came to live in a home that I bought 6 or 7 years ago originally to give her a rent-controlled place to retire to. Of course, it all went to pieces, and I had to go to court and actually throw her out of the house because she was ruining my life and actually driving my tenants away. She has a man, her husband, who was born with some congenital deformations, one of them in his back and one of them a brain condition. I don't remember the exact name for it, but his brain is not actually the hemispheres of his brain are not actually physically connected and wired up to the degree that most people are. It's so severe, apparently, in his case that there's very little neuronal connection between them. He's not mentally retarded. He was a professional. He was a newspaper writer. He's a writer. You know, he's competent. But it does affect his memory, his concentration, his ability to follow tasks. I told a story in the first episode about my mother screaming at him when he went to the grocery store with a grocery list and brought back the wrong brand of orange juice or butter or something like that. And she said, "I write you a fucking list and you can't even do that. Why are you so worthless?" This is also the man who, when she gets angry at him, she says things like, "Are you a fucking retard?" There came a time when I was afraid that my mother was going to seriously hurt her husband. My sister was texting me about this, and she showed me screenshots from my mother's phone where my mother was threatening to throw a skillet and break his head open. And then one day she did throw a skillet, and it didn't hit his head. It hit the wall in my apartment and put a big hole in it. And she thought this was very funny. Well, at least it was in his head. LOL. There were more signs than this. I'm not going to take you all through them, but I was scared for this man, and I really was worried that she was going to hurt him or kill him. So I called Adult Protective Services at the state. Worthless. I wanted to rescue him. So I waited. I actually drove up the country road that my second house, the one I rent out. I drove up the road and I kept my car at enough of a distance that my mother wouldn't see me parked, but I could see her if she left. And I waited for her to leave and go to the grocery store in her car. And then I called her husband on the phone. And I said, "I'm very worried about you. I know what mother has been doing to you. I know what she's been saying. I want you to know that my sister and I can see this. You're not alone. It's abuse, and we will help you get out if you need to." I wasn't prepared for his response, and his response was to turn on me and tell me I was crazy. He got very angry. This was really hard to process because, like I said, the man is not mentally retarded. It's not like I was speaking to someone with an intellectual disability, but he is vulnerable. He's physically and mentally vulnerable because of his congenital birth defects. And he said I was crazy. He said I was the abuser. He said I had been making up stories about my mother. And now he understood what kind of person I was, and he understood why my mother said that I was this kind of person, because now he could see it. He could see what a terrible son I was. He said, she's not abusing me. You're abusing her. And it's really hard to know how to react to that in the moment. This was not what I was, and I'm on the phone with this guy, and I'm like, who am I talking to? And I don't remember how it ended. I was so shocked. I hung up the phone and I just burst into tears and cried in my car and called my sister. I did not have to deal with it. And he then joined my mother's smear campaign against me. He sent me emails and messages, any way he could get to me electronically. And my mother's smear campaign was to try to make me look mentally unstable in front of my colleagues in the organization that I work for. She called up at least one of my colleagues and said, as most people who know me know that I've been a depressive and I've been on antidepressants of one sort or another for most of my life. It's nothing I make a secret out of. It's not shameful. Lots of people are on antidepressants. But she would call up and say, I wonder if Josh might not be taking his medication. He doesn't seem right. Plausible deniability. What she was trying to do was to make people think that I was unstable and perhaps a liability to my job. Well, her husband picked up on this. And he was a newspaper journalist, and he was stringing and doing freelance stuff when he lived in Vermont. And he told me about the story that he was going to write up about how his wife's son was an elder abuser who worked and directed a nonprofit charity and who was really a narcissist in disguise, who had not a compassionate bone in his body and was dangerous for a charity, shouldn't be given the keys to drive the car. And he was quite direct about it. He directly threatened. He said, I'm going to ruin your reputation. You're going to look so bad in front of the court that you're not going to know what hit you. I'm not even sure how I feel about this guy. I don't even know if I'm angry. I was angry. I was scared at the time. I was still a little bit outside of reality. Like I said in an earlier show, when my mother threatened to turn me into Adult Protective Services as an elder abuser for not being her marijuana drug runner. I was flashing back to the fact, to the time that my mother did actually institutionalize me. She did actually confine me. She jailed me when I was 12 or 13. But of course, I'm a grown man now, but I couldn't see outside of the paranoia. So I don't know what to think about a person like this. I don't know if this means that he too is a cluster B or... he came from an incredibly abusive background himself, much like my mother. I mean, my mother picked up somebody that she could manipulate and abuse and recreate her own childhood with. But this is what flying monkeyism can lead to. You can get people who act just as vicious and unethical and sociopathic as the actual abuser. So I leave you to consider this. Think about what you're doing when you play along with this stuff. I realize that, you know, most of you listening to this are not going to be that deranged. You're not going to do something horrible like that. But maybe you are keeping silent when somebody else is being abused. Maybe you're not saying anything when you see your friends being harangued on social media, when you see people saying, hey, does she work at National Life Insurance? Maybe her employer should know what she thinks about trans women. If you don't say anything, you're getting real close to flying monkeyism. And when you comply, when you say yes, ma'am, when you use the pronouns, when you say trans women are women, it's low. I know that sometimes you do it for protective camouflage, and it's pretty low. It's not something you should be proud of. It's something you should be ashamed of. Cowardice is not something to take pride in. But when you actually go further and you participate in these things, you are engaging in narcissistic abuse. You are the Wicked Witch's flying monkey. Think carefully. Thanks for listening to Disaffected. We've got a new listener line, so if you've got something to say, give us a call. 202-979-2480. And just a note, we do reserve the right to play messages on the air. If you like this podcast, please share and please subscribe. We're on Apple, iTunes, Spotify, Rumble, YouTube, and anywhere you get your podcasts.